We're back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the Zoom. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Naomi Klein. She's a senior correspondent at The Intercept. She's also the Gloria Steinem Endowed Chair at Rutgers University. Her new book, How to Change Everything, The Young Human's Guide to Protecting the Planet and Each Other, will be published tomorrow. And she'll be launching the book at the Brooklyn Public Library virtually.
In other words, I'll just be sitting in this chair.
It's too bad, because I would have loved to have actually physically gone. But and you'll be in conversation with the Sunrise New York City Youth and Tocada Iron Eyes from Standing Rock tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern. Folks can check that out at the brooklynlibrary.org. It's B-K-L-Y-N. I don't know why they couldn't spell out Brooklyn. But Naomi Klein, welcome. We're here, of course, with Emma Vigeland. And I wanted to talk about specifically your piece in the Times today, because it had occurred to me. I was on vacation last week. And as I was watching this, it occurred to me that I was not hearing the classic, we shouldn't politicize this. Mm-hmm. And your piece really sort of made it clear why.
Well, great to be with you, Sam and Emma. There was this symphony of voices from the Republican side, clearly a coordinated talking point that they were going to get out of the gate and politicize the hell out of this with blaming the Green New Deal, blaming renewable energy. They had all of their memes ready with frozen wind turbines and snow-covered solar panels. And it was just like, just within a couple of hours, we were hearing it from Greg Abbott, Rick Perry, Ted Cruz. They were all, pounding the same drum. And I think that, it's very clear why. I think they're terrified of a Green New Deal, which actually has the potential to solve many of Texas's huge intersecting overlapping problems, which is the whole point of a Green New Deal. So, they had to deflect right out of the gate.
It was a fact. We'll circle back to this, but it was just fascinating to see. And I think, one of the things I really want to touch on that is this notion that in your piece about having these ideas, having ideas at the ready for a crisis. I mean, of course, I can't imagine, or I should hope that we don't have too many people watching us who haven't read The Shock Doctrine by now. But we were also just, before we started recording, we were talking about your piece that you and I discussed 17 years ago.
When we were young.
A little scary. About year zero, and referencing Baghdad. Explain just for a moment.
Just to be clear, like that piece, there was a piece that came out in Harper's in 2004, and it was called Baghdad Year Zero, Pillaging Iraq in Pursuit of a Neocon Utopia. And that was the sort of piece that turned into the Shock Doctrine. That was my kind of, my wake up call about this is what I thought at the time was a new tactic of harnessing the power of shock and trauma. In that case, the shock and awe military invasion of Iraq, that was how it was branded, to push through so-called economic shock therapy, to use this kind of window of opportunity that opens up in the aftermath of a hugely traumatic event to do things you would not be able to do otherwise. So what I was reporting on for Harper's was this push to sell off all of Iraq's state-owned industries, to roll back labor protections. I mean, not to say Saddam Hussein's Iraq was some socialist utopia, but it did have some protections for workers, and it did prevent foreign investors from coming into the country and buying up state-owned industries. And so that was what the Bush administration was determined to do in that window of opportunity. And in the process, they actually ignited a very forceful Iraqi resistance, and the rest is history.
Well, have they almost kind of perfected this too? I mean, the level of coordination that we've seen, like it's almost like they use, as you cite in your piece, Katrina, Iraq, all of these other past disasters as a trial run, and the machine is so well oiled. You had the Wall Street Journal and Breitbart within hours come out with this anti-green energy push in terms of messaging. Then, of course, Fox followed. And then really, I think Abbott, Cruz, Dan Patrick, they were going on Fox News regurgitating their own talking points. So it's almost as if they have it down to a science at this point.
Yeah, but I think we're getting kind of meta here because what we're seeing with attacking the Green New Deal is not what I've described as the shock doctrine. I mean, the shock doctrine is using the window to push through privatization, deregulation, austerity, the whole neoliberal playbook, right? The problem is in Texas, they've already implemented the entire playbook, and that is what produced the crisis. And what they're terrified of is that the reality of the effects of their policies will spur a progressive response to disaster. And, you know, in the shock doctrine, I go back and really look at the origins of the strategy and, you know, exploiting crisis is not a new idea. I mean, Machiavelli talks about it. But I'm talking about this within the context of neoliberal history.
Right.
And I often quote Milton Friedman in an essay he wrote in 1982 for an anniversary edition of Capitalism and Freedom, where he says, only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When the crisis occurs, the change depends on the ideas that are lying around. That's a key word, lying around. And he says, that I believe is our basic function. And here he's talking about not just right-wing economists, but the whole infrastructure of right-wing think tanks that he was intimately connected to. Cato, American Enterprise Institute, Heritage. Get your ideas ready. Store them like canned goods and toilet paper for when the disaster hits, and then you pounce, right? And what's interesting about that is that Friedman was obsessed with the New Deal. And he believed that everything went wrong when the market crash happened in 1929. People saw the cruelties of this economic system, both the instability and its willingness to allow so many people to fall into such desperate poverty. And that was the shock that brought about what Friedman hated more than anything else, which was the original New Deal. And I quote him in a letter he wrote to Augusto Pinochet in the 70s, saying that history took a wrong turn, he says, in your country as well as mine in the 1930s, when people got the idea that they could do good with other people's money. So what they are terrified of is that their shock doctrine strategy has been tried, failed. Their ideas aren't lying around. They're lying in ruin. And they're afraid of another New Deal. They're afraid of the Green New Deal. They're afraid that we're the ones with the ideas now to actually solve the real problems. And that actually gives me some hope. You know, I mean, I think that's interesting. It's very different.
All right. So let's go backwards just a little bit, because you mentioned Pinochet, and it was the first thing that you know, because I think when we spoke in 2004, I don't know if we used the term neoliberal, frankly. I mean, it's possible, but. And when we're talking about this type of neoliberalism, we are talking very sort of almost strict definitional Mount Pelerin type of stuff, where there was a specific agenda set out following World War II to make sure that something like the New Deal doesn't happen again.
Yeah.
And it took. They had it. Maybe it was 30 years, basically, until you get to Chile, where they had the opportunity. They build up these ideas, and there's their opportunity to deploy it. I mean, I think Iraq was probably the next sort of biggest single moment where they had that opportunity again, which was to implement, you know, to really sort of like really lay this project out. And it's
well, there were other ones in between, you know, like the collapse of the former Soviet Union, like other major shocks, right, which create this kind of blank slate a state or what they imagine to be a blank slate. You know, whenever anyone uses that phrase, blank slate, blank sheet, you know, that's when you need to be very afraid. But yeah, they were ready, not just with the ideas, but with the people. This was really important, right? As far as Latin America was concerned, in Latin America, they talk about the Chicago Boys being the economists who worked with Milton, who worked with Pinochet and other dictatorships to impose these radical privatizations. That was only possible because there was a 20-year process at the University of Chicago where hundreds of young economic students were brought from different parts of the world, but particularly Latin America, hundreds of young Latin American economists to be trained under Friedman and other far-right economists. It was originally funded by the State Department, then it was funded by the Ford Foundation. And so when that shock came, they had their personnel ready. You know, Pinochet had the guns, but it was the Chicago Boys who wrote what was called the brick, which was this very thick manual for what they should do with the economy immediately after the coup.
And so we have now sort of almost gone full circle where they have had the opportunity to, and particularly in Texas, to implement these things. And it's sort of like the dog that catches the car. Right. And this, their the front of their face is now smashed in because they've run out of these ideas. I mean,
how desperate do you have to be in Texas to claim that the Green New Deal produced this? I mean, Texas is as far from the Green New Deal as you could possibly imagine. It's a petro state, right? Yes, they have some wind turbines, but the vast majority of their energy comes from gas and coal. It was that infrastructure that froze up because of the, you know, you have the collision of fossil fuels, successful decades of deregulation, not telling the fossil fuel companies that they need to winterize, telling them that they didn't need to do anything to prepare for a crisis. They just needed to maximize their profits and do whatever it took to make the most money in the short term. And then you have climate disruption, which is intimately linked to this ideology, because the reason we have failed to act in the face of knowing about this crisis and decades of expert testimony before Congress is that this crisis lands on our lap. Right. And this is what my book, This Changes Everything, was about. The, you know, James Hansen testifies before Congress, the country's leading climate expert, and says in 1988 that he can now say with, I think he said, 99% certainty that humans were causing the planet's climate to change. This is 1988. The worst possible moment for this to happen. It's the year before the Berlin Wall collapses. Francis Fukuyama is about to declare history over. Right. Margaret Thatcher has said there is no alternative. It's the high point of the free market revolution. And that is a disaster when it comes to climate change, because if we're going to take this crisis seriously, we have to regulate corporations. We have to hold on to the levers of power within our states, including control over energy, and not just hand it over to the free market, because we need to get to renewable energy in a hurry. You know, we have to question all the fundamentals. And of course, we need to invest in the public sphere, which is exactly what they're telling us we can't do. So Texas is in this like overused phrase, but a perfect storm of all of these crises born of the successful implementation of these policies hitting all at once.
I'm trying to look back over the past 20 years where we had similar moments like this that did not create the panic that I think we have seen from these Republicans out of Texas over the past week that Emma just described as a sort of like coordinated response that was born out of panic, right? Because you can't go to the well. There's no other, you can't redeploy what has already been deployed there. And I'm looking at, you can, but not so much in Texas. Like you can't say like, we're going to double up on, we need to have
never say never, Sam. They can always make things worse.
At least they didn't feel confident they could.
No.
Right. I mean, and so, right. But I'm thinking like the financial crisis, which they didn't have the same panic that came from that in the same way. I'm thinking Kansas, where they had the opportunity to implement the supply side economics, like the tax cutting, you know, the whole Laffer curve, the idea that this is going to increase revenues, and it failed miserably. I'm thinking austerity in 2010, that was, you know, it failed even worse in Europe because it was implemented more,
right.
But there wasn't the same sort of like, this is just so naked, their panic.
Right.
And what do you attribute that to?
So what I attribute it to is the presence of an alternative political program, which is really what is different than previous shocks that have exposed the failures of this economic project. You know, I think about Katrina, 2005. Once again, a collision of heavy weather of the kind that we are seeing more and more of that linked to climate change, slamming headlong into a deliberately neglected, austerity-starved public sphere, overlaid with systemic racism and white supremacy. And so you have the storm slamming into the levees that there had been years of warnings, repair them, they're crumbling, ignored. The levees break, they breach. Fox News is talking about people being looters when they're actually just trying to get water and food. They're talking about animals in the Superdome, and it's just people trying to survive. People are abandoned for days. You remember FEMA couldn't seem to find New Orleans for 5 days.
It had been fully privatized, not fully, but it had been extremely privatized after one of, and Bill Clinton, there's not a lot of times I say positive things about Bill Clinton, but FEMA under Bill Clinton had been built up significantly. And under George W. Bush, it had been privatized rather quickly.
Privatized and handed to totally inept cronies. Remember Michael Brown? I mean, it was one of those moments. And in the shock doctrine, and I did this again in the New York Times piece, I quoted all of these sort of free market zealots who suddenly lost their religion, looking at what it actually means to have no government. And all the people who took so much delight in talking about, you know, drowning the government in the bathtub. Jonah Goldberg was saying, okay, where's the government? In a crisis, you actually want the government to saddle up, was his phrase. You had neocons talking about how the fall of New Orleans levees was going to be for Reaganism what the collapse of the Berlin Wall was for Soviet communism, because it revealed its failures. And so a lot of us, there was a moment there when that happened, that a lot of us thought, okay, this is going to be the moment, and there is going to be a rejection, and there is going to be an alternative. But what there wasn't back in 2005 was a broad-based social movement that had a vision for what the next economy should look like. You know, and that vision is best encapsulated in the phrase the Green New Deal, which is not one policy. It's a host of policies. It's a vision for fighting climate change and racism and every kind of inequality and getting off fossil fuels within a decade. And so that we didn't have that in 2005. And so in the absence of having our own ideas lying around, to use Milton Friedman's phrase, they just went in there and they went further. They privatized the school system. They demolished public housing. That's why I say, don't say, never say never. There's right. always more public sector to destroy. There's always more that can be privatized. There's always more ways to take a crisis that was created by elites and hand it over to people who can't take it anymore. We saw it in Europe after the financial crisis. They are panicked because finally the stranglehold that the neoliberal project has had over the progressive imagination for 40 years is loosened enough that we aren't just saying, no, this is terrible, stop it. We actually have our alternatives, and well, they are ready to go.
And do you think part of what increases their panic as well is the fact that those alternatives are a part of, I guess, you know, you could capitalize on that. There is profit to be had on the other end in the alternative, as opposed to what we saw in Katrina or in the financial collapse, where that was just more regulation on existing markets, as opposed to tearing down an economy or not just tearing down an economy, but bringing new profit sectors to an anemic American economy. Like, that's part of also why I think, you know, maybe Democrats are more willing to accept some of these ideas too, more traditional Democrats who would have been more amenable to a neoliberal project, say 10 years ago. Does that make sense?
I think, well, look, there's money to be made in renewables, which is why that's why there's wind power in Texas, right? I mean, a not insignificant amount of wind power. It's not the reason the power went out, but it's around 20% of the grid. So I don't think it's so much about whether there are markets in this or whether there are markets, but I think you're absolutely right, Emma, that I think that there's support for these policies or some parts of these policies in the Democratic Party establishment, because absolutely renewable energy is a growth sector. You can create a lot of jobs. But I think what Texas shows is that it isn't just about having a renewable energy market. It has to be regulated. I personally think it needs to be in public hands. I think we need energy democracy. I mean, and public doesn't mean like one big state power sector. In Germany, they have hundreds of cities and towns that have remunicipalized their power grids in order to get to 100% renewable energy, because private players wanted to do it, but they wanted to do it more slowly. And we have to do it so fast that it might not be profitable in the short term. And we have to be honest about that. I think that there's a lot of sort of happy talk about how, you know, this is all going to be great and growth and jobs and so on. And there are going to be jobs and it is possible to do, but there are also going to be some players who lose a lot of money in this process. And so, you know, coming back to your point in Texas, yeah, it's a petro state. And so there's not going to be the same kind. Renewable energy is a sector where you can create a lot of money, but it lends itself to decentralization in a way that fossil fuels don't, right? And this is, I think, a really key point. Fossil fuels, by their very nature, they're buried in the ground, okay, in specific places. So you have to spend a lot of money to dig it up, and then you need to spend a lot of money to transport it and process it. And because of those very, very costly, just necessary for running it, right? Just sunk costs. That lends itself to monopolies or just a few big players. You're not going to have a mom and pop fossil fuel operation, right? Whereas renewable energy, if you're talking about wind and solar, it's everywhere. So it's decentralized by its very nature. And so what that means is that, yes, people can make money, but you're going to have many players making less money. And so a political structure that, like Texas and like the Republican Party generally, that is built around an oligarchic power, right? You have a few big players, and those big players fund up a whole political operation. They are very invested in keeping that level of centralization and are very threatened by a model which says, hey, you can put solar panels on your rooftop and become a competitor to your local utility. So your customer becomes your competitor. That's no fun. That gives you way less power, right? Political power and economic power.
And more actual power. I would add to that. I just, you know, spoke with Andreas Malm. I don't know if you're familiar with him. A Swede who's just written a book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline. I should say it's not a specific manual. But he had written a book,
Fossil Capital.
Fossil Capital, yeah. Which makes that very point. And on some level, you have the investor class. They invest in this huge apparatus to get the oil out of the ground. They are looking at 10x, 100x more in terms of returns on that fossil fuel. On some level, there's an analogy between the investment that in returns that people expect from, let's say, a cable news program versus this one. a bunch of these combined might be able to generate the same amount of revenue. But in terms of an investor class, the returns are just simply not going to be there.
Right.
And so that's why they're going to fight this. And ultimately, we can't rely on the profit motive or incentive to, you know, this isn't one of those sort of like clash of the of titans where you have.
And it's often why you'll have there's a big lobby that's pushing really hard for nuclear. Right. And it spends a lot of time lying about renewables and claiming that that they're not efficient, that it's not possible to have the kind of backup power, which, of course, we can have with battery power. And I've tried to understand, like, why is it? Why are they so invested in pushing nuclear, which obviously has way more risks than renewables? And we know what those are. And I think it's because it's more of a one-to-one substitution, right? Nuclear has the same sort of ownership structure as fossil fuels, ton of money to get it out and process it. And it lends itself once again to a few big players that are going to make a hell of a lot of money. And it doesn't challenge that sort of concentrated either economic power or political power in the same way that renewables do.
We should add that the production when you talk about nuclear, you're also talking about sort of long-term financing. The production of energy with renewables, once you've done the initial investment on the infrastructure, it's hard to sort of like, you know, to juice the profits there because you've done all the heavy lifting, you know, at that point in terms of the generation of the energy. Once you've built the panels or the windmills, that's just happening at that point. All right,
You don't have to keep. You don't have to keep rebuying your input.
Exactly.
yeah. And that, you know, as Andreas Malm's research shows, that made fossil fuels a hard sell originally among industrialists in Europe, who were saying, "Well, why would I continuously rebuy coal when I'm currently getting my power from?" From water. They had these huge water wheels that were actually more powerful than coal power at the time. And Malm makes the argument that the appeal of fossil fuels was the power that it gave to factory owners to move their factories wherever they wanted and find the cheapest, most controllable labor. That it's always really been about power and not about electricity kind of power, political power.
Yeah. Well, so let me ask you this. So the neoliberal project had the ability to have these ideas on the shelves, right? Like, you know, and through Cato Heritage, through, you know, I mean, on and on. They built an infrastructure that was able to sustain itself without responding to events in any given moment, right? Like we have, and like you say, in 2005, there was no infrastructure on the, you know, nominal left to respond to these crises with ideas. How do we sustain that?
It was very reactive, yeah. Like yeah, you had local groups trying to fight a demolition, but you know,
right. I mean, how do we sustain a basically like, you know, I mean, to use an analogy with what we saw in Texas, there was no regulation to have extra capacity in the system, right? It was relied upon these private actors. You guys, you're making so much money that you're going to reinvest to have extra capacity. Well, why would we? When that would be, you know, just in reserves, why would we do that? And they didn't. Regulation that we have in other places in the country.
They also just don't care, Sam.
They don't care because there's no incentive.
Ted Cruz flying off to Cancun. It's like, you know, this is like a metaphor for how these guys actually think, which is that they're going to be fine.
Exactly.
And when the shit hits the fan, they are getting on a plane and leaving. Their wealth and power will protect them. This is really important to understand about Republicans and so-called climate deniers. They know climate change is real. They think they're going to be fine. That is why they feel free to play games.
And these energy companies know that they can get, you know, Abbott to jump on TV and say it's the Green New Deal so that they're not going to, you know, have to go back into some type of regulatory regime. They'll ride it out in 6 months.
They'll get bailed out.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but how do we develop a sustainable movement without the resources that the right has to, like, you know, because I'm just thinking about back when we had our first conversation, yeah. there was a blogosphere. And there was a lot of people, it was a new technology, a lot of people were going on, they were doing this as amateurs. But over time, you know, when George Bush went away and there wasn't the urgency and the immediacy in that moment, there was nothing to sustain their voices. And all of that just sort of evaporated. Some went into, you know, sort of more institutional work, but it dissipated. Mm-hmm. How do we prevent any type of dissipation when there is no, when it's that much harder to maintain, you know, I mean, we have people who are very, but it's hard to maintain this unless, like, you have resources.
Right. And you have to have that kind of discipline to have your plan and push your plan when there are openings. And so we are in better shape than we were in 2005 or 2008 when the financial crisis happened and you had, you know, Occupy Wall Street eventually, but you didn't have a set of clear demands about, okay, well, what do we want instead of this failed system? So we are in a better place than we were. We have the squad. We have key policy planks that we're pushing for. We've had two Bernie Sanders presidential campaigns that have put these ideas solidly on the map, whether it is canceling student debt, whether it's free college, whether it's Medicare for all, whether it's ending mass incarceration, defunding the police, moving that money over to a Green New Deal. We have made a lot of progress in terms of those affirmative demands and having an affirmative vision. You know, like I said in the piece, after Katrina, there was no squad, there was no Sunrise Movement, the climate justice movement was nascent at that point. So we've done a lot of work, and we need to give ourselves credit that, you know, there has been progress. DSA, was a few thousand people. It was not the sort of political force that it is now. Justice Democrats didn't exist. There is infrastructure on the left that has been taking ideas seriously, investing in ideas, investing in vision, not just issues, right? This is the problem that we had a right that was deeply funded in its worldview. Milton Friedman represented a worldview, a vision for what the world should look like. A terrible vision, but a vision, a dangerous vision, but a vision. And then you had liberal foundations that were funding narrow issues. You know, these people will work on environment. These people will work fighting racism. These people will work for gender equality. But there was not a vision for what the world should actually look like, because frankly, that was threatening to these liberal foundations, a lot of them, who weren't interested in that kind of deep change. They wanted kind of band-aids. So there has been a shift. That is why they're going after the Green New Deal. It represents a thawing of that frozen imagination, and that, you know, that was really successful in the Reagan-Thatcher project of saying, you are not allowed to talk about alternatives. There is no alternative. You can critique what we're doing and say you don't like it, but that is different from saying we actually have a different plan for what the economy should look like. I think they're telling on themselves by going after the Green New Deal as hard as they are. I think that's a hint that this is really where we need to do more work. We need to invest more in that sort of idea infrastructure. We need movements cooperating more on that holistic vision. And we just need to stay the course, frankly, because I think we're in better shape than we've been in a long time. I know that seems like a weird thing to say at such a dire moment in Texas, but the fact that they are going after the Green New Deal means they're terrified that the left is the ones that have alternatives that can speak to where people are at. I mean, Abbott is a monster. He evicted thousands of people from their tents in places like Austin just to get them out of the way, you know, a year ago. And then the pandemic hits, and now this, you know, these weather shocks of the kind that we're going to see more and more of in a warming world, in a destabilized climate, they've got nothing to offer to people. And people need real solutions. They are in pain. And that is the kind of conditions that won the original New Deal. And that is what's scaring them.
What is the next step mechanically? I mean, it's one thing to say, like, keep going on in this way, but let me rephrase that. Is there a
Biden?
I mean, I think that's across the board. I think that mm-hmm. that is, but is there a specific next step, or is it like all of the above and see which works?
I think that we need to be investing in that intellectual architecture. We need to be taking it seriously. We need ways of funding it that aren't dependent on liberal foundations that are never actually going to believe in it. I think we are seeing the power of the squad, and we need to keep enlarging the squad. And so, you know, looking forward to the next midterms, you know, we need to be thinking about that. I think we've made some progress, and I think that there never should have been a honeymoon with Biden. I think he was better than we expected out of the gate, but now what we're seeing is that Biden is Biden.
Right.
He is not our friend, frankly. I mean, if you want a Green New Deal, Biden's not your friend. He's co-opted a lot of the discourse, but when it comes to doing the really hard things that involve standing up to donors, we cannot rely on him. And so this moment where it is so clear to people that small sort of tinkering solutions are not the fit for our era of big overlapping and intersecting crises, that is the moment where we need to be pushing as hard as we possibly can, because no, he's not FDR. I mean, FDR wasn't FDR before he was FDR, but Biden isn't FDR.
Well, he's not LBJ either, which is the loftiest hope. He's not that either.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're in better shape, but we're not where we should be. We're not where we could be. And that's why there's a lot of sad Bernie friends thinking about Nevada, right? This time last year, my last happy day 1 year ago when we won Nevada.
Oh yeah. I was in Vegas. I won money there. That's a rarity too. You know, that doesn't happen often.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good place to end. I mean, I think, you know,
just
one
sad
of the other
Bernie emojis.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's actually one other thing that occurs to me too that I think is interesting about this Green New Deal phenomena is that it feels like, and this is early in this new era, but it feels like that bankruptcy that you're talking about in terms of a response has also had a structural implication for the turf that Republicans are fighting on. Like, you know, there is no, you cannot, you know, even in the context of this $1.9 trillion the COVID relief bill that the House is, scheduled to pass this week. They're in the middle of committee markup, and then it's going to go to the Senate, and we're going to get that. The what's in it isn't necessarily all the things that we want, but the voices of austerity, the voices that I would have anticipated a year ago, if I didn't know that this was going to happen, I would have said there would have been, the Republicans are going to come out and they're going to talk about like the deficit and the debt and this and that. And they don't even seem to be engaging in that. It is, they're immediately sort of moving into a different silo, almost like a different playing field where it's like, we can't even pretend anymore about the whole deficit debt thing or the austerity thing. It really, the issue is like, I think they're sort of, you know, flopping around for what it is, but it's going to be something more cultural, and they're not even engaging. There's no Paul Ryan to pretend that like, oh, I'm thoughtful about that. They don't even seem to be engaging in that. And I think, I mean, A, is that your sense as well? And B, if it is, that is even more of an opportunity for those of us to put some real ideas into the discourse.
It is. I mean, I agree entirely that there is a sort of an eerie silence on the deficit front. It doesn't mean it won't come back. But I think the pandemic is a pretty tough time to be playing austerity politics. It can always get worse, though. And however it comes back, I mean, you know, you say cultural. Look, I think, you know, even when it comes just to climate, one of the, you know, we often talk about how do we convince climate change deniers, right? One of the scarier prospects is what happens when people on the far right stop denying the reality of climate change. And then they just have this sort of unmasked eco-fascism, which far-right parties in Europe have fully embraced, like Marine Le Pen in France. She's not a climate denier. She fully says climate change is happening, and that is why we have to lock down the borders, protect our own. And this is very kind of alive in the bloodstream in Texas. When you think about the El Paso massacre in the Walmart a little more than a year ago. This was a shooter who was inspired by the New Zealand mass shooting at the two mosques. That was a self-described eco-fascist. The guy who, I mean, I don't use their names, but in El Paso, he went to Walmart, he said, because he realized that if brown people start consuming the way Americans do, then the planet is destroyed. So he went to Walmart, a Walmart that is frequented by Mexican-Americans and by Mexicans coming across the border, to basically say, you're not allowed to shop like us, right? So when we say it's going to come back and it's cultural, I mean, it's monstrous. The cultural form of this is really monstrous, not to say that it isn't monstrous now. But yeah, things can always get worse, which is all the more reason why we need to be very clear about how we respond to climate change, massive inequality, systemic racism, all at the same time. And that's called the Green New Deal.
Naomi Klein, your new book, I think, as you're aware, How to Change Everything, The Young Human Guides to Protecting the Planet and Each Other, is going to be released tomorrow. And tonight at 6 p.m., you can check out Naomi at a virtual book launching at the Brooklyn Public Library. We will put a link to that. It's BrooklynLibrary.org. I don't know why they just couldn't do the whole Brooklyn, but we will put a link to that at majority.fm and in the podcast and YouTube description. Thank you so much, Naomi. Really appreciate it. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks, Emma. Take care.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye.